states and large-scale mask orders, while many others are no longer requiring proof of vaccination to travel or to enter dining facilities. Recently, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, issued new guidelines that loosened its recommendations on social distancing and quarantining. Individuals who were exposed to COVID-19 no longer have to quarantine unless they develop symptoms or test positive. Unvaccinated people who have been exposed should test on the fifth day of exposure and wear a high-quality face mask. Additionally, the CDC no longer recommends screening asymptomatic individuals who have not had a known exposure to the virus. CDC epidemiologist Greta Mazzetti said in a statement, "This guidance acknowledges that the pandemic is not over, but also helps us move to a point where COVID-19 no longer severely disrupts our daily lives." Arqaban Sales disagrees. She said, "The new guidelines, suggesting people who have been exposed don't need to quarantine but should instead wear a face mask, is likely to accelerate the spread of the disease, especially because they don't even say what kind of face mask. What is, in their view, a high-quality mask? And given the lack of face mask mandates and the overall low rates of people wearing face masks, it seems unlikely people would comply with this anyway." She said, "Their guidance suggesting those who have tested positive only need to isolate for 5 days, but should avoid being around those who are likely to get very sick from COVID-19 indicates they only care about isolation if the person who is likely to be infected is at high risk. Not many people are aware of other people's health problems, medications, or their immune systems. As a result," Sales says, "this guidance will put more people, and especially those with disabilities and immunocompromised status, at greater risk for getting sick." Currently, only 67% of the US population are considered fully vaccinated. Moreover, only 32% of the population have received a booster dose. Healthcare officials have repeatedly stressed the effectiveness of vaccines in mitigating COVID-19. However, vaccine hesitancy as a result of misinformation, wariness, and other factors continues to hold many back. Earlier this month, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, warned individuals that if they are not up to date with their vaccines or booster vaccine shots, they will experience a difficult fall and winter. Dr. Anthony Fauci said, "If they don't get vaccinated or they don't get boosted, they're going to get into trouble," adding that the country's vaccine and booster rates are quite discouraging. According to Dr. Fauci, booster shots that target newer variants such as BA5 will probably be available next month. He said, "If you aren't worried about your personal risk, do it for your communal responsibility." In May, the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, Dr. Ashish Jha, predicted that the U.S. may experience a major surge in winter with 100 million new infections and a significant number of deaths and hospitalizations. World Health Organization, WHO, spokesperson Margaret Harris said, "We're indeed very much still in the middle of the pandemic with intense transmission globally, with close to 1 million cases daily and sadly over 14,000 people dying every week." Margaret Harris added, "With such high levels of transmission, it is not surprising that the SARS-CoV-2 virus continues to evolve." With the pandemic slowly moving out of the public's consciousness, healthcare workers continue to face a daily battle, fighting not only the virus but also significant staffing shortages in the field and a slew of mental health issues. According to Matthew Allen, a nurse at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, who spoke to the New York Times, many hospitals across the U.S. are facing a severe nursing shortage. In New York, the nursing shortage is at an all-time high. Judy Sheridan Gonzalez, a nurse in the city's Montefiore Medical Center, who has spent 40 years in emergency rooms, told Spectrum News that she used to attend to six patients at a time. Now she sometimes attends to 20 patients. She said it's impossible to cover people during their breaks. You do the best that you can. According to a recent survey by the Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association, 13.6% of nursing positions at acute care hospitals in Massachusetts are unfilled. There are over 5,000 nursing positions that need to be filled statewide. In addition to healthcare workers, many individuals are still severely affected by the pandemic as they experience post-COVID conditions or long COVID. Symptoms include protracted brain fog, fatigue, chest pains, hallucinations, heart palpitations, and difficulty breathing. Research is increasingly showing that hundreds of millions of people are probably suffering from long COVID-19 globally.
Economic Divide.
When it comes to the topic of sanctions, Iran took the number one spot for years, maybe even decades. But now there's another country that has taken that spot, Russia, and it has beaten Iran to a pulp, thanks to the U.S. and European sanctions, which Russia says is so extreme that it can never repair its relationship with Europe and the U.S. Hi, I'm Kaveh Tahweh. Welcome to Economic Divide. These are some of the headlines that we'll be covering in this program. Western sanctions, good for Russia. It has promoted and put into motion self-sufficiency for years. An economic war that the West waged has backfired. Next, we take a look at the sanctions outcome. How have countries actually coped with it? What has occurred? Import substitution is one thing that has happened. Then, non-reliance on Western goods, which in turn meant domestic manufacturing increased. So those are some of the positive points that we'll be looking at in this program. Also, the sanctioned countries, Russia, Iran, and China. A result of the U.S. and Western sanctions, de-dollarization in full effect. In the case of Russia, it has strengthened its currency, the ruble.
When the war started in East Ukraine in February 2022, the West, led by the U.S., rallied behind Ukraine. Washington and its allies in Brussels began to impose a raft of anti-Russia sanctions. Russia's oil and gas revenues have in fact increased. The Western embargo has prompted Russia to seek new customers. It is now selling more oil to China and India. And Moscow is benefiting from higher oil and gas prices. It is estimated that Russia earned a record 93 billion euros in revenue from exports of oil, gas, and coal in the first 100 days of the war. That has led many to question whether the sanctions are really effective.
Well, it's time now to take a look at what people are posting online about this. One thing that actually people don't realize is the fact that Russia has been under sanctions since the year 2014, 2015. That's when the barrage of sanctions gained in its intensity, coming from the U.S. especially. And countries like Iran, for example, well, they've been under sanctions. Iran has been under sanctions for decades at this point. But it's interesting to see how the people actually think about this and how they have coped with it. So let's move on to our first post, where, in this case, the point this particular person has said, ZTE continues to act like U.S. sanctions are just the cost of doing business in Iran. It should be obvious how ineffective this kind of thing is if China and Chinese companies are repeatedly ignoring them in the face of large fines. Next up, Western sanctions work. Russian airlines, including Aeroflot, are stripping jetliners to secure spare parts that they can no longer buy abroad. So this particular person is under the belief that, well, yes, sanctions do work. Next, are Western sanctions on Russia really working? Oops, Russian oil and gas revenues surplus more than triple to $167 billion. Now, that caught our attention. So we went into the website to see what's up. Russian oil and gas revenue surplus more than tripled to $167 billion. And it went on to say from January to July, the surplus ballooned to $267 billion compared to just $50 billion for the same period last year and $138.5 billion for the first 6 months of this year. Wow, that's how much Russia actually has increased its revenues by, thanks to sanctions. Well, let's find out what our guests think. Let me introduce them. Our guests joining us for this edition of the program, we have Peter Kuznick. He's a professor of history, director at the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, who joins us. He's also co-author of The Untold History of the United States with Oliver Stone, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. Very well. That's a pretty full resume that you have there. Welcome to Economic Divide, Peter Kuznick. When you take a look at the way that the U.S. and the European partners have tried to choke the Russian economy, how do you view it? I mean, according to one economist, Western sanctions are good for Moscow, making the country move towards self-sufficiency. What do you think?
Russia has been trying to become self-sufficient for almost a decade now. The U.S. first imposed those sanctions in a big way in 2014 after Russia seized Crimea and supported the uprising in the Donbass. So the United States and the West have imposed heavy sanctions for years now. Russia, in response, has become increasingly self-sufficient. That has worked in certain areas more than in others. It has worked largely in terms of foodstuffs. Russia is also very rich in minerals and in energy, but there are certain things that Russia still needs from the world economy. We look at the effect on Russia's auto industry, on its airplanes and aviation, technical matters. The world economy is integrated in that way.
All right. Sergei Strokhan now joins us. Sergei Strokhan is a journalist and political commentator with Russia's Kommersant Publishing House. Sergei Strokhan, welcome to Economic Divide. Any country threatened by U.S. sanctions is forced to become self-sufficient. It's something that has been said. And in terms of Russia, we are seeing how it has moved towards import substitution and on track really to become completely free of reliance on Western goods. What would happen if all countries that were under U.S. sanctions adopted this strategy? Wouldn't that have a negative impact on the U.S. economy in a sense?
Well, I'm not in a position to talk about European and U.S. economy since I am talking from Moscow. As far as the effect on Russian economy, there's no clear-cut answer on what would be exact damage made to Russian economy. In fact, there's ongoing debate here among economists, and there's no one opinion. Some are saying that we will withstand that pressure, and they say that what is not killing us makes us stronger. And in the long run, all the sanction war will make us stronger. Others argue that this is a rhetoric and we should not deny the very fact that, of course, we will suffer. We are already suffering. So in terms of the consequences for Russian economy, you have to look for short-term, mid-term, and long-term consequences. I hope by that moment, by that time when the Ukrainian conflict is over, they will realize that they have achieved zero result and they first harmed themselves.
Several academic studies have concluded that sanctions almost never work.
Any international sanction would jeopardize energy security, and the consequences would be the high cost of energy and raw materials.
Hello, and welcome to the InfoNews section of the program. This is where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Well, first up, we're going to take a look at an economy that has been battered. namely the U.S. economy. Now, based on the Financial Times, it has been cited to be the worst performing G7 economy, as it revealed. Second quarter GDP, it shrank by more in the U.S. than in the U.K., Germany, France, Italy, Canada, and Japan. Thus, that is how it has performed comparing next to the other G7 countries. All right, next up, let's take a look at what India is doing in terms of its economy. Projected to become Asia's fastest growing economy. This has been cited for quite some time, actually. Morgan Stanley has announced that it expects the country's GDP growth to average roughly around 7%, 7% through the year 2023. That's not that far off, and that's solid GDP growth. Let's see if that transpires. All right, next up, something that is happening in the U.S. Stock exchange, and that is Chinese delisting. China state-owned giants are actually delisting from the U.S. stock exchange, which adds to a growing financial rift and tensions between the two biggest economies. So there you can see that the toll is now incurred on the U.S., on the financial markets there, through the stock exchange, and of course that affects in one way or another the U.S. economy. And finally, we actually have two more. This one caught our attention. Is about Argentina. All the way in South America, the inflation there is actually quite astronomical, to hit 69.5%. It's surging to that inflation rate is a 30-year high for that country. Now, Argentina's inflation woes and political upheaval actually not only contributed to that, it got worse for the month of July when the then economy minister, Martin Guzman, abruptly resigned. So that's one of the reasons why inflation in that country has risen to a record high. And finally, taking a look at the conflict that has erupted between the United States and China over Chinese Taipei. China's new normal for Taiwan raises fears for global trade. One headline read, in which military exercises in the crucial shipping route will become regular events. And just recently, you had a small U.S. delegation of five congressmen and women who traveled to Chinese Taipei, again, arising China's anger.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to our in-depth section. When it comes to sanctions, especially the ones executed by the U.S., do they actually work? I mean, do they really achieve the intended goal that the U.S. is after? And in the case of Russia, has it worked on that country? Well, let's go find out if it has or not. But first, let's put things in perspective for you when it comes to Russian sanctions and see how other countries fare. And we've done that in the form of a graph, which includes a number of countries. It's quite shocking, taking a look at Russia as a whole, 10,000 sanctions. Now, Iran used to be the record holder. It has a little over 3,600, but Russia has three times that amount. And what's interesting about this is the area in orange that you see over here, roughly about 3,000 sanctions, they were applied before February 22nd. So the rest of the sanctions from there on up to the 10,000 was after February 22nd of this year. And, of course, the other countries and the relative numbers speak for themselves: Iran, Syria, North Korea, Venezuela, Myanmar, and Cuba. Obviously, these countries are all in the same camp. So the sanctions for Russia are so much more than the rest. Whether that's going to affect Russia's economy, that's the subject of this program. You'd be the deciding factor. Now, the sectors that are targeted by these sanctions from the U.S. and its European allies: energy, no surprise there. We've seen what that's done to the world economy. Also, the military of Russia has been targeted. And in terms of finance, just banks, their financial institutions, etc. Again, this puts into question whether it has achieved the intended results when it comes to the way that the U.S. wants to cripple Russia's economy. Let's see what the Russians think and feel about so many sanctions executed against their country. Now, no impact on their lives in the year 2015. 60% of Russians thought that. Remember, back in the year 2014 and 15 is when the sanctions started accumulating from the U.S. and then from the Europeans. And no effect in the year 2020. 90% of the Russian population actually thought that. So that's quite interesting when you think about that, as to the way that Russians feel about that. And when asked, they just said, well, they just adjusted their lives to the sanctions. I guess they really didn't have any choice. Of course, the state of the economy is what determines the true impact of the sanctions. For example, when we take a look over here at the unemployment rate, well, for the year 2021, 4.3% is what it stood at for Russia. And then when it came to the inflation in general, or inflation price growth, 2.2%, and that was back in the year 2018. So the impact, you be the judge, is not as severe as the U.S. would like it to see and its European allies. The West anti-Russian sanctions, in terms of all the goals that it wanted to obtain, weaken the ruble, increase inflation, a big one, break logistics chains, which in a sense is a lead up to the next one. When you break logistics chains, it's with the intended goal of creating shortages of consumer goods. Now, again, did that really happen in the case of Russia? And even with other countries, are those goals actually what the U.S. has achieved? Well, that remains to be seen, especially in the case of Russia. Moving on to the final piece here that we have for our in-depth section, what is the ultimate goal that the U.S. is after? Well, this is what the U.S. and its European allies are after: to bring discomfort to Russia's inhabitants and to create social tension. All of that, that particular sentence there, means that they're after regime change. That is something that many are concluding. So wait and see game to see whether they're going to actually obtain that or not. Let me bring back our guests and see what they think. Peter Kuznick, who's a professor of history and the director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, rejoins us. Peter Kuznick, welcome back. Looking at, even before the war in Ukraine, there were efforts to actually de-dollarize. That's one of the things that Russia needed to do. And it has started for quite some time. The intention, of course, the Western sanctions. But in essence, it has backfired. It actually, in the case of the Russian ruble, the currency, it has strengthened it. So was de-dollarization something that has helped Russia in the process?
Well, de-dollarization has been in process for at least 8 years. And what we've seen is that more and more countries like Iran, like Russia, like China, like Saudi Arabia, and many others, are much less dependent on the dollar than they were. The U.S. tried to kick Russia out of the SWIFT system for international financial payments, and Russia began creating an alternative system. We've seen that now with trading going on in rubles, where trading going on in other currencies. The dollar is less central, less salient than it had been. And that's the trend. The ruble has gotten stronger, not weaker, as a result of all of this.
All right. Let's find out if Sergei Strokin agrees and how he sees the way that the Russian economy has been impacted by these sanctions. He rejoins us. He is a journalist and political commentator with Russia's Kommersant Publishing House. Sergei Strokin, welcome back. Even though the U.S. and its European partners have tried to choke the Russian economy, obviously through their sanctions, it seems like the strategy has backfired. Do you agree with that? I mean, when it comes to Russia as a whole, in terms of its economy, many are saying that it has become self-sufficient. What does that even really mean, when an economy becomes self-sufficient?
Thanks for having me. Let me start by saying that there's a perception of any sanctions, and Russia is not an exception, as a double-edged sword. It means that if you have a sword, you know, if you want to hurt someone, it can backfire. And this is the textbook example of what's happening with Russia. In fact, it was not the European Union, but President Biden who initiated this unprecedented sanction war. But the grim reality is such that, yes, we are suffering from sanctions, they're creating a lot of problems. They make government to reconsider the whole import-export strategy. They make government to think of alternative ways of payments. In addition to that, that also affected in a severe way Western economies. European Union is suffering. Look at the prices of gasoline in the United States. Look at Japan.
Russia is now turning toward other partners, like China and Iran, to make up for the loss of Western-made consumer products. There are now serious attempts on the side of Russians and its partners, like Iran and China, to put away the U.S. dollar in their business transactions. Even before the Ukraine war started, there were attempts to de-dollarize their economies. The move to do business without the U.S. dollar would significantly reduce Washington's attempts to impose sanctions on their economies. U.S. sanctions and its economic belligerence have led other world economies towards self-sufficiency. For decades, China has made giant leaps in economic achievements. China is now the world's second-largest economy and is expected to overtake the U.S. economy in the coming years.
It used to be, in the 90s, that the U.S. manufactured 37% of the world's chips. Today, it's down to 12%. So the problem is, how do we go create an economic situation, an economic model that brings manufacturing back to the U.S.? And that's what the CHIPS bill is to do, is to close the global competitiveness to make manufacturing a reality back on shore in the U.S. And GlobalFoundries, once the CHIPS bill is funded, at this very facility we're having this discussion at today, we'll be expanding our capability to create more chips in the U.S.
We have talked a lot about how U.S. sanctions have been applied to other countries with the aim of weakening or decimating their economies. To use the words of Iran's former foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, it's economic terrorism. But did you know that U.S. sanctions actually hurt the U.S. economy? Brookings Institution gets it right when it says, when it comes to how U.S. sanctions hurt the U.S. itself, it describes U.S. sanctions as expressions of U.S. preferences that hurt American economic interests without changing the target's behavior for the better. But how does that happen? How do U.S. sanctions hurt the U.S.? Here is one of the unintended consequences. Unilateral sanctions are rarely effective. Unilateral sanctions impose greater costs on the U.S. businesses than on the target, which can usually find substitute sources of supply and financing. For example, sanctions can be expensive for American businesses, farmers, and workers. Sanctions cost U.S. companies billions of dollars a year in lost sales and return on investment, and cost many thousands of workers their jobs. Really? Impose greater costs on U.S. businesses than the intended target? Let's take the Russian example, since we are focused on Russia in this program. Not only have U.S. businesses lost money, so have businesses from other countries. Business losses from Russia topped $59 billion as sanctions hit. Nearly 1,000 Western companies plan to leave the country or cut back operations, with more write-downs expected. Then comes another form of sanction. It's called secondary sanctions, and the U.S. is using that to threaten other countries. Let me explain. Trying to compel others to join a sanctions effort by threatening secondary sanctions against third parties unwilling to sanction the target can cause serious harm to a variety of U.S. foreign policy interests. And here is a look at how the European countries, the same ones supporting the U.S., were a victim of U.S. sanctions. This is how much money they lost when the 2015 agreement was signed and Europeans started doing business with Iran. Clearly, these European companies lost a lot of money because of these secondary U.S. sanctions, which should not have been applied in the first place. And that is exactly why the U.S. is accused of weaponizing sanctions. That does it for this segment of the program. Please give us your feedback and let us know if it was useful or not. When it comes to the word self-sufficiency, it is one that spells out a whole array of things. But at the center of it, it's all about manufacturing and domestic production. I mean, if a country can produce products that it does not need to import, then it has won the game. It gives value to its currency, for example, it creates jobs, and it adds to the country's GDP in more ways than one. and it does not have to, in the U.S. case, listen to its diktats. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. Hope you liked it. For Miko Vitahwe, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former President Donald Trump appears to be losing the support of some of the most prominent figures in conservative media, despite the fact he may be preparing for another White House run. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Derek Roche. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled How Donald Trump Lost Powerful Media Conservatives. Former President Donald Trump appears to be losing the support of some of the most prominent figures in conservative media, despite the fact he may be preparing for another White House run. Conservative media, and in particular outlets owned by billionaire media mogul Rupert Murdoch, have long been broadly supportive of the former president. But there have been signs recently of moving away from Trump in recent weeks. Just this week, both Fox News host Laura Ingraham and InfoWars host Alex Jones signaled they had distanced themselves from Donald Trump, though Alex Jones was more direct in endorsing one of Trump's potential political rivals. Alex Jones said during a live stream on Wednesday 17th of August that he had been persecuted for his support of Donald Trump, and that made me kind of pigheadedly support him a few years ago, even though I disagreed with his warp speed, referring to the Trump administration's COVID-19 vaccination program. But that said, I'm supporting DeSantis. DeSantis is just gone from being awesome to being unbelievably good. He's getting red-pilled more and more each day. I'm a DeSantis guy, Alex Jones said. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is considered a rising star in the Republican Party and a potential rival if Donald Trump chooses to seek the 2024 GOP presidential nomination, as the former president has repeatedly hinted that he will. Alex Jones's change of heart appeared to be based on Trump's support for the vaccine. Laura Ingraham, one of the most well-known Fox News hosts, told The Truth with Lisa Booth podcast this week that she had doubts about Republicans backing Trump if he ran again, and said the country was exhausted by the battle involved in supporting Donald Trump. They may believe that, well, maybe it's time to turn the page if we can get someone who has all of Trump's policies, who's not Trump, Ingraham said. She suggested that candidates who supported the same policies as Donald Trump might be a better option for the voters. The other problem is that it's really not about Trump, Laura Ingraham said, but rather the views that Trump now brought to the floor for the Republican Party. Fox Corporation Chief Executive Officer Lachlan Murdoch has privately criticized Donald Trump, according to a CNN report on 10th of August, citing sources familiar with the matter. Lachlan Murdoch also reportedly freely criticized the former president's behavior and said that it would be bad for the country if he were to run again for office. Lachlan Murdoch's father, Rupert Murdoch, is co-chairman of the Fox Corporation and executive chairman of News Corp, which owns the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal. There have been multiple reports that the elder Murdoch has criticized Donald Trump. Both newspapers took aim at the former president in July as a result of the hearings of the House of Representatives Select Committee investigating the events of 6th of January 2021. The New York Post wrote that Trump's actions on 6th of January were a matter of eternal shame, while the Wall Street Journal said that Trump had utterly failed the test on 6th of January, which former Vice President Mike Pence had passed. Those editorials may have been an indication that Rupert Murdoch was attempting to break with the former president. The 6th of January hearings also prompted a harsh rebuke from the Washington Examiner, a prominent conservative media outlet, following the testimony from former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson. The Washington Examiner declared Trump unfit for power in an editorial on 29th of June. Trump is a disgrace. Republicans have far better options to lead the party in 2024. No one should think otherwise, much less support him ever again, the editorial said. The former president has not formally declared his intention to run for the White House again in 2024, but he has repeatedly hinted at it during public appearances. It remains to be seen how that campaign might be affected by prominent conservative media figures moving away from Donald Trump, or whether they will rally around him if he wins the GOP nomination once again. Meanwhile, a video calling for former President Donald Trump to be locked up has been viewed more than 1 million times. The video highlights words from some of Trump's previous speeches regarding classified documents. The video comes after Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida was raided by the FBI in search of classified documents. Following the raid, Trump criticized the FBI and said that Americans are angry about what he has called a witch hunt. The video began with a clip that has gone viral on social media in recent days. In August of 2016, during Donald Trump's presidential campaign, he spoke about how he would protect classified information. On political corruption, we are going to restore honor to our government, Trump said. In my administration, I'm going to enforce all laws concerning the protection of classified information. No one will be above the law, Trump said. The video then cuts to a news report discussing the FBI's findings regarding the Mar-a-Lago raid. The FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago was intended to recover Donald Trump's personal stash of top-secret and confidential documents.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha.
One day, the field of jihad is the military field, such as during the sacred defense and in defending the holy shrines. In such cases, the field is a military one. In those days, many individuals correctly understood their duty and carried it out. Of course, it was an obligation that required a number of people to do it. It was not compulsory for everyone to do it. In that field as well, the hay'ats carried out their duty in full, as I explained before. Many of our soldiers and our martyrs were members of hay'ats. And then one day, the field of jihad is a scientific field. In this field, one must work to improve the level of science in the country. And one day, the field of jihad includes social activities and public services for the people. That day is when the enemy is trying to exert economic pressures on society, thus pitting the people against Islam and the Islamic government. If you render economic and social services to the people at such a time, you're actually doing jihad to confront the enemy. However, the most important field is the field of clarification and enlightenment. If there is clarification, all these fields will become clear in the right circumstances, and the people will find their path on their own.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I have reliable information that today a multitude of media sources that cannot even be counted, especially due to the circumstances in the internet, are busy working using thousands of experts. These are experts in the arts, media and communication who are backed by substantial financial support and also support in terms of security. For what goal? They wish to turn around minds and opinions in the Islamic Republic and to weaken and destroy faith and belief. This is how things are. What plots are being devised for other countries is another discussion. The things that I am talking about are the schemes that are designed for our country, our people, our Islamic Republic and our beliefs. Thousands of institutions are working with huge amounts of money and various kinds of support. Well, this is a satanic move made by Shaitan's camp. What stands up to Shaitan's camp? The camp of struggle and jihad on the way of Allah. Well, you are the hay'ats. You should ask your own hay'at where it stands in this jihad.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The UK's biggest opposition party has entered into a membership crisis as close to 100,000 members abandoned the party over the past 12 months. On Tuesday, the Electoral Commission revealed that the UK Labour Party's membership fell by more than 91,000 in 2021, with a loss of income from membership fees contributing towards the party's end-of-year financial deficit of £5 million.
The question is, why is there a mass exodus of the Labour Party happening now, especially given the fact that over the past 12 months, it's been the ruling Conservative Party who have been embroiled in the majority of the headline-grabbing scandals? Well, speaking to Press TV, many former Labour members have informed us that it appears to be the direction in which the current leader, Keir Starmer, is taking the party in, which is proving to be a decisive factor for many.
speaking to a former Labour member, shocking accusations of racism, Islamophobia and a purge of left-wing socialists has left a bitter taste with former Labour loyalists.
It's a witch hunt. There's actually been a witch hunt, and I firmly believe that currently in the Labour Party, they are actively on a witch hunt to wean out anyone who is not in line with their party. The leadership is taking the party down a route of racism, down a route of pure and utter Islamophobia. They're not only losing the minority vote, but they're losing many other people as well.
Labour's membership increased significantly during former party leader Jeremy Corbyn's term, swelling to more than 500,000. The lifelong socialist eventually handed over power following years of stiff rebellions from right-wing Labour MPs, who now head the party. The latest figures raise serious doubts of whether current leader Sir Keir Starmer could win an election when he can't even win the hearts of Labour's own membership. Robert Carter, London.
One year ago, following the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan, the US froze about $7 billion in Afghan central bank assets and cut major international funding to the country. The measure, which pushed the Afghan economy to collapse, faced backlash from inside and outside Afghanistan. In February, US President Joe Biden signed an order, splitting Afghan assets between relief aid to Afghanistan and 9/11 victims. On Tuesday, nearly 80 family members of 9/11 victims sent a letter to Biden, saying the money belongs to Afghans, urging him to release the money without delay.
In fact, no law, regulation or moral orders permits a country to freeze the reserves of another country and create a situation where the owners of the money face economic suffering. The money, which is blocked by the US and its allies, belongs to the people of Afghanistan. As I mentioned, based on the international laws and moral norms, the US doesn't have the right to decide on Afghan assets, be it keeping the money or splitting it between 9/11 victims.
In Afghanistan, more and more people are going without job and cash, as the US sanctions have paralyzed the public economy. Frustrated Afghans call for the release of Afghanistan's central bank assets and solidarity from the international community.
The US should solve its disputes with the Taliban. Why is it punishing poor Afghan people? Both sides have had their battle and agreement. Today, the U.S. is stealing that piece of bread of ours which was supposed to fill the stomachs of our children. Why is the U.S. creating this dire situation which everyone is hungry and poor? In addition, we have been the victims of the terrorism and we can't pay the price for 9/11.
Majority of the Afghan population is in need of humanitarian assistance. More than half of Afghans are going hungry and more than 1 million children are severely malnourished. The humanitarian situation in Afghanistan is getting worse day by day, and the country needs its frozen funds for an economic recovery. It remains to be seen when Washington opens its eyes on the miseries of Afghans and returns their money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Shuttered stations and picket lines. Another day of severe disruption in the British capital.
We're just outside an underground station in West London, usually a very busy station, but today it is closed. The same thing or very limited service across many different stations in London for 24 hours.
It comes a day after another mass walkout of railway workers. The advice from the authorities, avoid traveling on the tube if possible.
I'm with them because it's true. When you're 60, why should you retire? I mean, why should they give you redundancy?
I mean, the cost of living's going up and all that. They're asking for a fair thing. Same in any job. They're offering silly things like 3% when inflation now is 10%. So I'm fully behind them.
I understand the people. That's normal. They are workers. They need more money, of course. Everything is rising.
A major bus walkout will also affect travel in parts of the capital. While a second day of rail strikes is expected to disrupt services around the country on Saturday. Almost all are part of widespread stoppages in recent months organized mainly by the National Union of Railway, Maritime and Transport Workers, locked in a face-off with the government
over modernizing changes, wages, and pensions, among other things.
People in this country are fed up with low pay. Many millions of people have had not a proper pay deal for a decade. So public sector workers in healthcare, education, transport, all sorts of services have been subjected to pay cuts and rampant inflation.
The ongoing strikes are inspiring other public sector workers, such as nurses and teachers, to do the same in the face of rampant inflation forecast to top 13% this year.
In the next few months, you're bound to see a convergence of trade unions all taking very direct action, calling their members on strike in an effort to protect the cost of living increases and the deterioration of wages that we've seen for workers across the country.
The government has threatened to use emergency powers to block future strikes. The unions, on the other hand, say they're not relenting unless they receive new deals they deem acceptable. Saeed Purizza, London.
Turkish main opposition party CHP has criticized the government for, quote, its double standards in regards with the Palestinian cause. The reaction was made after Turkey announced that it will appoint an ambassador to Israel, 4 years after Ankara cut its ties with the regime over the killing of 60 Palestinians by Israeli forces during a protest on the Gaza border. Deputy chairman of CHP parliamentary bloc Engin Özkoç said, it seems AKP has not heard about Israel's latest aggression in Gaza, adding the government has forgotten its promises to Palestinians.
Erdogan used to describe Israel as a child killer and a terrorist regime. Since the Marmara incident in 2010, Erdogan set conditions for normalizing relations with Israel. Those conditions weren't met, but what has changed now? Israel's killing of Palestinian children continues and has not stopped. A week ago, Palestinian children were killed in Gaza by Israel. Hasn't AKP heard about Israel's killing of children in Gaza in the latest Israeli attack? And now, they are rushing to normalize relations with Israel? They deal with the file in two different ways, and they have forgotten their promises to the Palestinians and our people as well.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu said Turkey is not giving up on the Palestinian cause. However, it is important for their messages to be conveyed directly through the ambassadors. For the past few months, Turkey and Israel have been trying to normalize ties. Back in March, they announced a new era in their relations after the Israeli president paid a visit to Ankara and met Erdogan. Turkish people have always criticized the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian land. They have repeatedly taken to the streets to protest against the Israeli aggression in the Gaza Strip. While anti-Israeli sentiment runs high in Turkey, analysts say Ankara's whole foreign policy is changing, with this normalization being part of a new political strategy taken by the Erdogan administration. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Another mass walkout bringing the UK's railway network to a grinding halt, causing major disruptions. Tens of thousands of signalers, maintenance workers, ticket collectors fighting for their rights as negotiations with the government for better pay and conditions hit the buffers.
I support the workers that are striking.
We're being inconvenienced, but they're being treated unequally.
Many rail employees, often working unsocial hours in a high-pressure environment, say they have seen no pay rise in 3 years, as the specter of soaring inflation, predicted to surpass 13% over the next year, looms over negotiations. The Conservative government has offered a below-inflation pay rise and accuses the unions organizing the strikes of taking the country for ransom. Despite that, public support for the strikes is on the rise.
I'm quite sympathetic to the train strikes, and actually the other industrial unrest, because it comes on the back of minimal increase in wages over a long period of time, a pay freeze much more recently, and an offer which is frankly way, way, way below the current rate of inflation.
Stoking the public ire, Common